Blog Talk Radio.
You got to listen to the Bob Carson Show. It's about the real deal. And this is Les Leopold, the author of Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009, when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on, not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Greg Palin, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio. Radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
Listeners, and welcome to Carson's Corner, the place where you'll get a revolutionary socialist perspective on the news, on the headlines, what's been going on in the last week. And I'm here tonight joined by Rainer Shea, our good friend Rainer Shea. Rainer, how are you?
Hello, glad to be with you on here again. I'm figuring out my new routine amid this time. I'm going to certainly have lots of free time in the summer, and I'm eager to figure out what I can do with this time to best serve the revolution.
I know what you mean. This is a time when people are figuring that out. I have some ideas that I'll shoot your way here and there. But I'm sure that you're reaching out to a lot of people and absorbing what's going on. How's things going otherwise? I got to say, too, you're coming in loud and clear for a change. You must be doing something different because we're getting a loud, clear signal from you, which hasn't been the case the last month.
I'm using the landline instead of the cell phone. In the last month, I've been using the cell phone because it's cheaper.
Yeah. Well, the landline comes in much more clearly. That cell phone, you got a big problems with your cell phone. So does Bob. Tell you the truth, Bob really sounds poorly on his cell phone. I don't know why. You guys must be getting moisture in your speaker or something because it just sounds kind of garbled. But anyway, it's good you're coming in loud and clear. We love hearing the truth coming from you, ringing out, and that's what Rainer delivers, the truth. You've been busy the last week. I've seen, I think, 3 articles from you in the last week. We've got 2 of them up here as topics to discuss tonight. Got 6 topics, and I think that people will find that there's something there for everyone to learn, for everyone to appreciate. The theme of tonight's show is economic collapse is going to get a lot worse, and that is also the headline of one of Rainer's recent articles that I just conveniently stole the headline for the name of tonight's episode. So, and not coincidentally, that economic collapse is going to get a lot worse is the topic number one tonight. It's a topic we start out with. So, Rainer, I'm wondering if you can describe for people what you were getting at with this article. Really has maybe a lot more in it, a lot more meat, so to speak, than the title indicates, although the title kind of says it all. And I got to say, there are other topics up here, but the economic collapse is really driving things in today's world, and it's driving pretty much everything. The COVID-19, of course, is uppermost in most people's minds because it is so immediate and so disastrous for a lot of people and so disruptive of our lives. However, that is something that's kind of a short-term thing, whereas this economic collapse, we knew it was coming beforehand, before we ever heard of COVID-19, of the coronavirus. We knew it was coming. It did come. It is going to be bad, as we've been telling you on Carson's Corner for the last few years. And it will be with us long, long after the COVID-19 crisis is but a memory. So, Rainer, what are your thoughts? What's going on with this economic collapse? Why did you choose to focus in on this?
I see how the unemployment numbers in America right now are actually a lot worse than you might have heard from the official figures, since by one estimate from this article I cite in my piece, this article from Mint Press News observes how the real unemployment number is around 40 million, which is almost twice what the government says. And these tens of millions of people who've been laid off of work in the last couple months, a lot of them aren't getting their jobs back. All these small businesses, a lot of them aren't going to be revitalized as all these small business owners are naturally getting discouraged amid the current situation of bankruptcy, liquidation, poor commercial prospects, and the big companies, the biggest corporations, they're consolidating the job market. They've been finding that they can keep operations running with a lot fewer employees, and in an economy like this, they're going to not rehire a lot of those employees so that they can save money while still keeping their operations going. So they're monopolizing the job market. I'm talking about the big monopolies like Amazon and Google, the tech companies, and companies like Amazon, which deliver things. They're naturally able to take advantage of the current situation where people are at home and wanting to order things more conveniently. So many jobs are disappearing, and in the coming years, we're going to see even more of a dynamic where people are forced into the so-called gig economy, where they take service jobs, or jobs in the remaining retail stores, or delivery, house cleaning, things like that. That's the main kind of work people are going to be able to get. Meanwhile, there will be tens of millions of unemployed people who are going to need to try to survive in a situation where the government will be eager to further cut social services, and all of this is exacerbating the innate instabilities that exist within the American economy, the giant bubbles, financial bubbles that exist in the banking system, the enormous amount of household debt that U.S. households have accumulated. All of this is blowing up in the face of American capitalism. And in the coming years, we're going to continue seeing the ramifications, especially as the climate crisis worsens.
Yes, the climate crisis is also looming upon us. You use the term gig economy. That's what they call it in America, but in Europe they tend to call it the precarious economy. They talk about precarious jobs. I think that's a much better, more descriptive term to use for this kind of economy that you are talking about. And because when people are forced to rely on participating in the precarious economy, they are in a precarious position. They are teetering on the edge, just ready to fall over, just ready to topple. And precarious these days is probably a pretty good description of the entire capitalist, imperialist economic system globally. It is in a precarious position also. For the last few decades, pressure has been building up. It's kind of like the pressure under a volcano getting ready to blow, or the pressure along tectonic plates getting ready to rip and cause massive earthquakes. Very similar to that, the position that the global capitalist imperialist economic system is in. The really, during the whole last 40 years, the four decades of the neoliberal era, we've seen desperate attempts by the capitalist class globally to keep profits, to keep the rate of profits up. And that term, the rate of profit, is really important. It's not just the absolute tons of money, piles of money, mountains of money that a few billionaires make. It's that figure, the rate of profit, has fallen, as Marx predicted it would, historically. It doesn't fall in a direct line of decline. There are ups and downs within it, but it has fallen over the long historic periods since Marx's time, 150 years ago. It's been falling to where the average rate of profit has been hovering between about maybe 8% and 12% over the last 40 years, and the capitalists have been desperate to push it up because that's their incentive. That's the whole incentive, the whole driving force of the capitalist system is that rate of profit. If that incentive falls too low, it's no longer an incentive. So they've been desperately trying to keep it up, and it's gotten to the point now, especially since the 2008 economic meltdown. We've seen banks, central banks around the world, including the Federal Reserve System, which is our central bank here in the United States, even though it's not a government-owned bank like central banks typically are. It's a bank that is actually a cooperative. It's a cooperative of the largest multi-billion banks, a very small number of banks that own the Federal Reserve System, and they control it. And they've been using it, especially since 2008, in what's called quantitative easing. And quantitative easing is basically these central banks creating, out of thin air, creating huge amounts of money to give to banks and to give to the largest billionaires, to give to the largest corporations that the largest billionaires own, to bail them out. It's been a constant bailout. Helicopter money is a term that some others use for this. It's just raining down money on these banks and on these big capitalists, these multinational capitalists and their multinational corporate concerns. And despite all this, and that's all aimed at keeping the rate of profit up, and still the rate of profit has been falling. Part of what they've been doing to address that problem is lowering interest rates of loans. They have. The interest rates are down to like 1% now. I mean, the historically lowest they've ever been, close to zero. And profit rates are still pretty low, historically speaking, drastically low. And that's their real desperation, capitalist ruling class. That's what they're really desperate about. And in the midst of all this, and because of all this, And because of the buildup of pressure, because of the fact that the economy gets to the point where it is suffering from massive overproduction, overproduction in the sense that more is being produced than they can sell. A lot of that is due to the fact that wages have been kept low, salaries have been kept low. So people, as you mentioned, Rainer, people are up to the nose with debt as it is, to the point where they can't afford to buy what they used to. And these loans, massive consumer debts, are what has been keeping the consumers going, because the consumers are not making the same amount of money through their wages and salaries as they once did, in terms of buying power. The only way they've been able to keep up is through having two people be the breadwinners in a household instead of one. That's been a big trend over the last 40 years or so. And taking out larger and larger and larger debt, to where the average American family is just overcome with debt right now. But this crisis of overproduction, it happens to the capitalist economy in cycles, and the cycles they come typically every 6 to 10 years. The last one was just about 10 years ago, 11 years ago maybe, and the shit's hitting the fan now. So this is going to be, I shouldn't even be laughing, but, you know, if I wasn't laughing, I'd be crying. I think it's a terrible situation for the working class, and there is only one way forward for the working class, the good way. You know, there are several bad ways forward. The bad ways forward include just sinking into worse and worse and worse economic quagmire and higher unemployment and so forth. But there's only one successful way forward that we as a working class can take, and that is socialist revolution, to organize for and to execute a socialist revolution, preferably on a global scale, because we really need to do this on a global scale. But those of us here in America, for those listening who are in America, you know, we need to focus on the overthrow of the American capitalist class and the state power of the American capitalist class, the capitalist ruling class. That's our way forward. So that's what we talk about quite a lot here on Carson's Corner. Rainer, any more thoughts?
No, I'm going to articulate the rest of them when you get to my talking about the other article you've selected. It's called The Fascistic Restructuring of American Capitalism. Sounds like you
right.
want to get more other things first.
Yes. We've got a little bit of time. And the next topic, topic two, U.S.-China tensions in the South China Sea rise to a crescendo. Over the last week, there have been really dangerous confrontations between China and the United States in the South China Sea. The United States has its Navy and Air Force all over the South China Sea, despite the fact that a lot of the South China Sea belongs to China and is in Chinese territorial waters. During one incident in the last week, an American ship was found by the Chinese Navy to be violating Chinese territorial waters, and China was forced to escort that ship out of its territorial waters. So there was one confrontation. Another confrontation, there have been several confrontations between aircraft of all different sorts. The American Navy has moved at least, I think, that I know of, one aircraft carrier task force into the South China Sea in a very threatening manner. Their airplanes have been violating Chinese airspace, flying over Chinese islands, flying over Chinese territorial waters, deliberately attempting to confront Chinese aircraft, and China has laid down the law and said that they're not going to put up with this shit, to put it bluntly. So this is getting kind of scary, and hopefully wiser heads will prevail and the American imperialists will back down. I'm not holding my breath, but that's my hope. Rainer, thoughts?
I remember how last week you described how Trump said that the U.S. would counter any Iranian aircraft that would supposedly harass U.S. warships, not aircrafts,
right?
The Iranian ships. So
yeah.
So this is the double standard that the United States is applying. It's in a situation where Washington is more and more getting involved in conflicts like these, ratcheting up hostilities with other superpowers. This is micromilitarism, the term historians have for imperial powers that lash out when their power is in decline.
Yeah, that's a descriptive way to describe that. Very illustrative. Yeah, I agree 100%. Iran's another. There was nothing quite as frightening going on with Iran this week, but I'm sure that will come up again, probably even by next week. So we'll get to that when we do. Meantime, this, of course, is just a larger, just a part of a much larger geopolitical plan, I guess you'd say, geopolitical conspiracy, you might call it. Against China by the American capitalist ruling class, directing their government and their armed forces to participate, really, in the ongoing long-term U.S. Hybrid asymmetrical war on China, which has been going on for several years, but things are getting really tense at the moment, really confrontational. And I think that China at this point has just had about enough of trying to appease the American capitalist class, trying to bend over backwards to accommodate the American government. So hopefully they will back down. Anyway.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Oh, and hopefully this will lead to China becoming more assertive, as you've been thing you want them to do. If they become more assertive, what exactly could this look like for China to take on this stronger stance?
Well, I mean, one thing I would say is what they just did. I mean, they didn't allow an American ship to invade their territorial waters. They immediately escorted that ship out. And if that ship had not moved out, they would have fired upon it. That's what they need to do. I mean, I've talked about this several times in just recent weeks, but what I believe China needs to do personally is call in the American debt, number one, which would cause a huge crisis for the American government. Number two, they need to get really serious about going after CIA agents and other saboteurs and provocateurs paid by the American government within China. They need to get very serious about putting the entire country on a war footing. They need to get serious, and they need to realize, to admit to themselves, the American government since 2011, since Obama's pivot to Asia, has been waging war on China, and it's about time for China to declare war on the United States, to put the whole country on a war footing, to cut off all trade with the United States, to recognize that, I mean, look, the United States didn't trade with Germany during World War II, or the UK, they didn't trade with Germany. I mean, it would be ridiculous to do so. You've got to cut off trade with your enemy, provide no aid or comfort to the enemy at all. That's part of what I would say. And, they need to take the kid gloves off and get tough, in my opinion. I kind of doubt that President Xi is listening to me, but hopefully, I'm pretty sure that officials high up in the Communist Party of China and in the Chinese government are telling him pretty similar things. So
they've already stopped U.S. supported terrorist attacks from happening. For the no terrorist attacks have been happened in China for many years now, from what I've heard, because of their measures.
Yes, they did a great job in I can never remember the name of that province, the far northern western province of China, where the U.S. has been infiltrating or helping to infiltrate Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists into that part of China for the purpose of waging sabotage and terrorist attacks. They really needed to crack down, and that's what they did. They identified and isolated all of those who who had come under the influence of these Al-Qaeda forces. They got them away from the Al-Qaeda forces and, gave them a re-education. As you say, they stopped it. That's what they need to do, and, definitely close those borders in the northwestern part of China to the entry of terrorists. Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what was needed up there. Topic number three, another failed coup, actually two coups over the weekend in Venezuela. The American government, along with Guaido, Juan Guaido, the fake president, the puppet fake president that the Americans put up, calling him the president of Venezuela when It's totally absurd. Most countries in the world just laugh at the Americans for calling Juan Guaido the president of Venezuela, because everybody knows that Maduro is the president of Venezuela, legally elected, popularly elected, and he's just a clown. But they have given Guaido billions of dollars that they stole from Venezuela. They seized Venezuelan assets in the United States, which included, you know, the whole Citgo network of Citgo gas stations and all the rest that it takes to supply gas stations. All of that was worth billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars, and the United States government just seized the whole thing and then turned the ownership over to Guaido. So Guaido's got a lot of money in the bank that was stolen from the Venezuelan people, and he's been using this money with American help, with American government and military espionage agency help. He's been using this money to fund military attacks on Venezuela. So this weekend, there were two attempts, and one of which about 300 men in a flotilla of speedboats, of small speedboats, were ferried from Colombia, from their training grounds, into Venezuela. But the Venezuelan Navy interceded before they could land. There was a sea battle. At least eight of the terrorists were killed in that battle, of the American-sponsored terrorists. All the rest of the out of those 300 men were arrested, taken away. So there's that. And then earlier on, another attempted coup took place on Friday in Venezuela, and this one was carried out by this guy, this character, who is the owner of a large private security force in Florida. This guy came out after the coup attempt was foiled, and admitted, even boasted, that it was his company, having been paid by Guaido and by the U.S. State Department and the U.S. CIA to carry off this coup. And then he was kind of angry. His name is Jordan Goudreau. He's an ex-Green Beret. He's kind of angry because Goudreau, he produced for the media a signed 212 million contract drawn up between him and Guaido, then he claimed Guaido reneged on the payment, never paid him. So he's angry about not being paid for doing this service for Guaido. But meanwhile, the American government and the CIA and the State Department all claim that they had absolutely nothing to do with that coup, with Friday's attempted coup. So in both cases, these coups were thwarted. The good guys were victorious. So what do you think, Rainer?
It's extremely repetitive what's been happening in the last year or so since in January of 2019, the Trump administration worked out this operation to try to legitimize their selected leader in the Venezuelan parliament and try to foist him onto the country. And since then, there have been so many conflicts that these people have manufactured. I think there was one in the fall. There was some sort of protest, and then there was something earlier this year where Guaido made a spectacle of climbing over a fence. And then last month there was the bluff threat to invade Venezuela. And now there's this. So this stuff is going to keep happening. The U.S. corporatocracy and the U.S. regime change machine are going to keep trying to break the armor of the Bolivarian Revolution, but it's going to be like it's been in the last 20 years. They're going to keep failing. Even when they got Chavez out in 2002, he was able to get back in, and that seems like maybe the worst case scenario of success for the regime change machine, aside from Maduro being successfully assassinated, which they're no doubt going to try to attempt again. They've figured out the Chavistas have figured out how to defy this, and it's incredible, actually an anomaly in terms of politics, since the Chavistas are a socialist government that came to power through electoralism and have survived. And it's extremely rare for a socialist government to survive after it's come to power through electoralism, as opposed to overthrowing the capitalist state. However, there have been the drawbacks of the capitalist class still controlling the mechanisms of government and the structure of the economy, which has been behind so much of the chaos that's afflicted Venezuela.
Yeah. We've got some callers. Let's see. Let me take the first caller here. It's a 404. I think I know who that is. Hello, 404 caller.
Hey, how you doing, man?
It's our buddy Nas. Long time no hear from, buddy.
Yeah, man.
What you been up to?
Oh, not much. Same as you, trying to follow all the news and all of the crazy stuff that's going on. But, good conversation you guys are having. I called in because I wanted to ask you and Rainer a question about this.
Okay.
Do you think how close we are to, you know, Chavez being gone and everything else, do you think that that affects how hard it's going to be for them to do what we know they're famous for doing as far as the U.S. Government and their foreign policy ideas? Do you think that makes it harder because people are – we're not talking about an elderly class of people who can remember the days of Chavez. We're talking about, you know, this is recent history. And then you've got the next generation who knows what it's like when the oligarchs take over again and knows what it's like when the U.S. takes over again. Like, do you think that has an effect on this? Because they tried every way, man, propaganda and also the way you guys just listed.
Yeah. Reiner, do you want to take a stab at this, or should I go first?
Oh, well, it sounds like you're saying that the Venezuelan people are naturally inclined towards being averse to the idea of a U.S.-backed leader taking over, because they're averse to the neoliberal paradigm. That sounds like what you're saying, because, you know, Chavez came to power as a result of a neoliberal U.S.-backed government before him, and Venezuela learned its lesson, and all of these poor and working class Venezuelans, all of these indigenous Venezuelans, they're in the majority of the country, evidently, and they're able to shape their country according to their own will, whereas the bourgeoisie and the white Venezuelans, they represent a minority. I don't know the exact demographics, but I'd sure as heck guess that whites are in the minority in Venezuela. So anyway, that sounds like that's what you're saying.
Yeah, well, I was just getting at how recent it was that they saw a different life. Like, during the Chavez period, we're talking about the majority of those people going from living in makeshift shacks to brick housing. The literacy rate, we've talked about way too much. But I just feel like historical memory is at play here. Because they've seen, like you said, they've seen the neoliberal government, but they've also seen the other side of the change that they were able to institute, the changes they were able to institute, you know, despite all of the aggression.
Yeah. Well, that was the reason that Hugo Chavez was so highly beloved throughout Venezuela. President Maduro has the problem of that he's not Hugo Chavez. Number one,
right.
He's not as charismatic as Hugo Chavez. And number two, President Maduro has the problem that since Hugo Chavez's untimely death, which I believe was an American conspiracy, but he died of cancer, since that time, the price of oil has plummeted to historic lows. Oil is really, really, I mean, there was a point, 2 weeks ago, where oil hit zero, minus. It was a negative.
Yeah.
You know, they were paying people to take the oil off their hands. Because of that,
oil was at $150 a barrel, and Chavez was able to do those programs, give money to Cuba and other Latin American countries.
The Venezuelan working class has, and the fact that the United States is putting onerous acts of economic sabotage and economic sanctions on Venezuela, the working class have been going through a hard time, and it has affected. I mean, there's still a core of, I think, 40% to 50% of the Venezuelan people who are solid backers of the Bolivarian Revolution, backers of the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, and backers of President Maduro. But there's another, you know, maybe 20% of the working class, probably, the aristocracy of the working class more than anything else, who are faltering in their support. So that's been a problem. However, militarily, Venezuela is still very strong. The United States can just not, nor can Guaido and his terrorist forces take on Venezuela. Venezuela is just too militarily strong for them, with 2 million people being in the citizens' militias, and another 1.5 million. People are in the regular Venezuelan military. They have a sufficient force to thwart anything the American imperialists and the Guaido and his terrorist forces can throw at them. So they've been holding on. As far as popularity, President Maduro in the last presidential election just got barely 50% of the vote, and just barely through the skin of his teeth made it into his second term as president. And the Americans keep pounding every which way they can. Hybrid asymmetrical warfare that includes economic sabotage and economic war, economic sanctions, which are an act of war against Venezuela, and they keep pounding. So, you know, we know that if you look back in history, the Nicaraguan people were very revolutionary people, and for a long time they held out, but the Americans kept pounding and pounding and pounding on them with their contra terrorists. It had an effect on the citizens there, where after 10 years in power, the Sandinista government was voted out. Of course, the Sandinista government has been back in Nicaragua for the last, whatever it is, 8 years or so. So things are, you know, back to their revolutionary roots, so to speak, back to their Sandinista roots. But they went for a good long time with a right-wing government, a U.S.-controlled government, and the reason for that was that people just got demoralized. Anybody can get demoralized. Demoralization is a terrible thing demoralization is a terrible thing that really is, you know, it can whittle away at a revolution. It's the greatest enemy to a revolution is not imperialist attacks from outside, but demoralization from inside. So, yes, Nas, that is really a big concern that you brought up, and you know, hopefully the Maduro government is addressing it in the way that it needs to. They
just grind at the people's quality of life. I'm sorry.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
They just grind you down, and that's why I was getting to historical memory being so important, because if people start to forget why things were the way they are and why the changes were made, it could easily slip into what you were just describing in Nicaragua. Very, very important point. I think a lot of people miss that.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, topic four. Kim is alive and well. I mean, there was all this brouhaha over the last few weeks about Kim being in grave condition or Kim being dead. You got various reports, and apparently none of it was true. I mean, he's in perfect health, at least from what the footage that I saw. The Korean government released footage of Kim opening a new factory and, you know, being applauded by the people. He looked pretty well to me and pretty much alive to me, very alive. So, once again, all these lies that the American government tell, all this propaganda bullshit, it's been exposed now. And, you know, this is just tip of the iceberg of the lies the American imperialist government tells against North Korea. I know that Rayner is going to have more to say about this. Rayner?
I took the opportunity this week to say in a tweet about how now that it's been exposed, this hoax about Kim Jong-un being dead, and now that it's clear that the U.S. media has lied about this in addition to all the other false reports of deaths and executions in North Korea, now that we know this, I hope more people start to recognize that the fundamental perceptions about North Korea that Americans are inculcated with are wrong. it's not true that North Korea is a monarchy or a dictatorship. It's not true that they torture or starve their people. They, you know, free speech and freedom of the press and freedom of assembly and transparent elections are protected within the country. There's evidence for all of this. It's as easy as looking into the nature of the DPRK's electoral system, which is overseen by election observers, and people aren't forced to vote a certain way. There are multiple parties in the DPRK. People choose from multiple candidates. It's not just one leader as it's portrayed as. And Kim Jong-un, he doesn't really have political power in the sense that he doesn't have authority over state affairs. He's a military commander who acts as a primary diplomat, and he has one vote within his party, the Workers' Party of Korea, and he can be recalled at any time. I've said this many times before, but if people look into the true nature of North Korea's political system, they can start to learn more about the lessons that it has for how socialist experiments can develop and build upon themselves. There's a beautiful set of ideas attached to this system, the Juche idea, the Songun idea of military first and fortifying defense against imperialist attacks. So I implore people to look into the socialist democracy that is the DPRK, and to try to apply that to their dialectics, to apply that to their own work in building the global socialist movement.
Okay. Nas, you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here. Beautiful statements by both of you. And the thing that sticks out is, okay, once the talk started between North Korea and South Korea, I think we kind of knew that they would try to escalate tensions. They would start attacking in different ways. I wouldn't be surprised if they start the buzzing again and the flyovers and every other aggression to attack the people. But I think a lot of Americans miss out on looking up Curtis LeMay and some of these American generals and really read what was being said during the Korean War. Look at what happened to that country during that time. And then you start to understand that, no, they're not the aggressors. They're the people saying we're going to defend ourselves against any imperialist. And they got good damn reason once you start reading into those, you know, those words from the American generals at the time about what they were doing, what the plans were and everything else. So, yeah, I'm not surprised that most people just took that story and ran with it. The propaganda against that country has been really, really, really deep. And they've convinced the majority of American people that it is a basket case nation that is being operated by a madman and that the people are all propagandized zombies. Now, an American population, mind you, is believing that, which is amazing. Americans who can't verify their own elections are, you know, assuming the things that they read are true. So, yeah, it's just sad. It's just sad how gullible we are.
This is the nature of imperialist propaganda, and it's the nature of how consciousness can develop in a capitalist society, especially in a capitalist society that's built upon settler colonialism. And the United States is also the core of global imperialism. So Americans have a certain interest in swallowing these myths about other nations and about America's role in the world, because the situation that that Americans, particularly white Americans, are in is that we're settlers here. I only mean white Americans in particular, and white Americans in particular make up the labor aristocracy that has a certain amount of solidarity with the capitalist class. So I'm coming to understand why Americans tend to think this way, why they tend to have hostility towards countries that go against the American interests, and why they tend to have these racist views towards countries like China and socialist Korea, because really the standard American view of North Korea is based in racism. I mean, the line is that North Korea is a monarchy, that it's backwards, that it's feudal, that it's barbaric. They're acting like this country is centuries behind the so-called civilized world.
Yeah. Okay, guys. Unfortunately, we're going to have to cut this discussion short. My phone is running out of juice. I'm going to not even be able to last here a couple more minutes. So we'll have to pick up the discussion next week. Same time, same place. Rainer, as always, thank you so much for the great contribution you've made to the show tonight. Nas, it was great hearing from you again. And thanks for your contribution to the show. So long, guys.
Same.
Yeah. Bye.
Good night, Joe.